KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Any of us is vulnerable to basically being kidnapped by masked agents of the United States government.
So far, the Trump administration is refusing to return a wrongfully deported man to the United States. So what are the stakes? For Sunday, April 13th, it's All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, we will hear about efforts to rebuild a composer's brain. We will get awkward and get some tips about dealing with inevitable awkward moments. With Passover and Holy Week underway, we will talk faith in film.
I think a lot of films in sci-fi, or that are technically sci-fi, actually live in, to me, in a spiritual space.
And we will go on a walking tour of Manhattan.
This isn't a normal tour. I'm not going to point at the Empire State Building as if you've never seen it before.
And hear how centuries of history shaped the city's modern streets. Those stories and more after this newscast. Stick with us.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The Trump administration said Friday imported electronics, from computers to smartphones, won't face additional tariffs. But today, Trump's top economic leaders say these electronics will face a new sort of tariff, and soon. NPR's Luke Garrett reports.
Companies like Apple, NVIDIA, and Microsoft can now import their technology and skip steep reciprocal tariff rates. But Trump's director of the National Economic Council, Kevin Hassett, tells CNN new tariffs on semiconductors, a key electronic component, are in the works. For Hassett, it's a national security issue.
Semiconductors are the key important part of a lot of defense equipment.
And Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick tells ABC News these tech tariffs are a couple months away.
So what he's doing is he's saying they're exempt from the reciprocal tariffs, but they're included in the semiconductor tariffs, which are coming in probably a month or two.
And Trump clarified in a social media post Sunday that all Chinese tech is still under a 20% fentanyl tariff. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
Police in Pennsylvania have a 38-year-old man, Cody Ballmer, in custody in connection with an arson attack on the governor's mansion early this morning. District Attorney Fran Chadro.
The charges will include attempted murder, terrorism, aggravated arson, and aggravated assault against an enumerated person. These are all very serious charges.
Police say Ballmer jumped a fence, managed to avoid state troopers, and forcibly entered the residence and set it on fire with homemade incendiary devices before fleeing. A security review of the mansion is underway. The FBI is involved, but it's not clear if Ballmer, who was apprehended in the Harrisburg area, will face federal charges. No one was injured, but the mansion sustained significant damage. Governor Josh Shapiro and his family were asleep when the fire happened. Police are still looking for a motive. Ukraine's President Zelensky says Russia has to be held accountable for striking a busy northeastern city with ballistic missiles today, killing at least 34 people and wounding more than 100. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports world leaders, including Secretary of State Marco Rubio, denounced the attack.
Speaking in his nightly video address, Zelensky thanked those offering condolences, and he warned that Russia's escalating attacks are only extending the war. Wars end when war crimes are not forgotten, he said, and when enough pressure is put on the aggressor. That's not the case now. Video footage of the aftermath of Sunday's strike showed cars and buses on fire, buildings collapsed, and bodies lying on the street. Russia has stepped up its attacks since the Ukrainian government agreed to a U.S.-brokered ceasefire a month ago. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
U.S. futures contracts are trading higher this hour. Dow futures are up about 0.4%. You're listening to NPR News. Northern Ireland's Rory McIlroy won his first green jacket at the Masters Golf Tournament in Augusta, Georgia today with a historic victory at the sport's most iconic event. McIlroy solidified his spot among golf's all-time greats as he becomes only the sixth golfer ever to win the Grand Slam, the Masters, the U.S. Open, the British Open, and the PGA. Sarah Palin gets a second bite at the Big Apple. Jury selection in her defamation suit against the New York Times starts tomorrow. NPR's David Folkenflik has more.
Palin filed the suit more than 7 years ago after the Times published an editorial against heated rhetoric. It linked her political action committee's online ad to a mass shooting in Tucson, Arizona that gravely wounded then-Representative Gabby Giffords. No proof was ever found that the shooter was motivated by or even knew about the ad. While jurors were deliberating, the presiding judge said in open court that he would rule against Palin regardless, saying she hadn't proved she had a credible case. The jury found the Times not to be liable, but several jurors admitted receiving push alerts notifying them of the judge's decision before their verdict. The appellate court sent the case back. ABC, CNN, and MSNBC have made payments to settle cases in recent months. The Times says it will vigorously defend itself against Palin once more. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
Pope Francis made a brief appearance in St. Peter's Square today, greeting crowds from his wheelchair at the end of the Palm Sunday service. It's the second public appearance for the 88-year-old after being discharged from the hospital 3 weeks ago, where he was treated for a respiratory tract infection. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Subaru. In partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Tomorrow, President Trump will host the president of El Salvador at the White House. And right now, a man named Kilmar Armando Albrego Garcia is incarcerated in El Salvador. He's there because he was recently deported by the Trump administration. The deportation was a mistake. The White House acknowledges this. And yet, despite a recent order from the U.S. Supreme Court for the Trump administration to, quote, facilitate his return to the U.S., the federal government has yet to do so. It's a case that legal experts say raises serious concerns about the rule of law and separation of powers. The worry that if this stands, the government could send potentially anyone to a foreign prison, regardless of citizenship, with no legal recourse.
I have suggested that, you know, why should it stop just at people that cross the border illegally? We have some horrible criminals, American-grown and born.
This is what President Trump said recently when asked about the government's power to send American citizens to El Salvador.
I think if we could get El Salvador or somebody to take them, I'd be very happy with it. But I have to see what the law says.
In a recent New York Times op-ed that he co-wrote, Harvard Law Emeritus Professor Lawrence Tribe argued, quote, we should all be very, very afraid of the implications of this case. I spoke with him about it and asked him why.
The reason, I think, was made even clearer by Justice Sotomayor in her concurring statement. She said the government's argument implies that it could deport and incarcerate any person, including U.S. citizens, without legal consequence as long as it does so before a court can intervene. Think about what that means. What that means is that literally any of us, whether we are from Venezuela or we're born in the United States, whether we are immigrants or not, whether we are citizens or not, any of us is vulnerable to basically being kidnapped by masked agents of the United States government who don't tell us why they're picking us up, perhaps never to be seen again because we're located somewhere in a dungeon, a prison cell, rotting away, whether it's in El Salvador or anywhere else in the world.
And that's due to the way the administration has responded, saying, well, we don't have jurisdiction anymore. You'll have to talk to El Salvador. We don't have any say over who's in a Salvadoran prison, to paraphrase the way they have responded to these rulings.
That's right. I mean, they've taken the position that even if it's clearly illegal and the government admits it, they say, too bad, too late, oops, the person is gone, and we cannot get him back. And all nine justices reject the idea that suddenly the greatest nation on earth is powerless and its courts are powerless just because someone is outside the country. That's not the law.
You are laying out an explicit, broad concern that the things happening right now give the Trump administration the case to basically throw its enemies in foreign jails. It's a very extreme circumstance you were laying out. Can you walk me through how you rationally get there, why you think that is not an overreaction?
The government removed this man, Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia, from the United States in violation of an order. That's not a hypothetical. It's not imagination. That's what they did. And the courts of the United States are told by the Trump administration, there's nothing we can do about it. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court responds, all nine justices saying, it is simply not the law that you have lost control. That sounds like a victory for liberty, a victory for all of us. But then when you look at the details, it's clear that the Supreme Court is basically writing its opinion in jello, because it says the district court should clarify the situation with due regard for the deference owed to the executive branch in the conduct of foreign affairs. Well, it's not as though this is a foreign policy issue. Then the Supreme Court in its order says the government should be prepared to share what it can concerning the steps it has taken and the prospect of further steps to facilitate the return of this illegally removed person. And in the hearing that was held, the government said, well, we can't share anything. It's a very complicated issue. What's complicated? The guy was illegally removed. He's somewhere in El Salvador. Tell El Salvador to return him.
Right. At the time you and I are talking, what happens next is an open question. The federal court hearing has taken place. The judge is clearly frustrated with the non-answers from the administration, has set a daily check-in deadline for more details about what is happening to Abrego Garcia. When it comes to your larger points, your larger concerns, how much does it matter? Again, it matters a great deal to Kilmar Abrego Garcia and his family as to whether or not he is immediately released. But when it comes to your larger concerns, how much would they be assuaged or heightened whether or not he's released from this prison in the next few days?
If he is not released in the next few days, that will be a signal to everyone in the country that they can be detained indefinitely by stalling maneuvers on the part of the Trump administration or any future presidential administration, unless courts get there before the government can move. It's a very deadly game in which the government is told, if you take people who are perhaps ideological opponents of the administration, immigrants, citizens, what have you, people that the government would like to get rid of, the way people have been disappeared to gulags throughout history, if you want to get rid of them, here's how you do it. You just grab them quickly and disappear them. That's where we will be if he's not returned.
And are you worried that could apply to American citizens as well as people in the country on any variety of immigration statuses?
Absolutely. Even if you are a citizen, when the government has grabbed you and taken you on a flight to nowhere, the fact that you might be a citizen is something they can contest. Oh, we don't know for sure that he was a citizen or that she was a citizen. How do we know? The whole point of due process is to make sure that what the government claims about you is true.
And let me ask you the flip side. If he is released in the next few days, do you still see a crisis here based on how this initially played out and the administration's initial response to the courts?
Well, if he's released, I will be somewhat relieved, but the position the government is taking is so extreme that his release, unless they pull back and say, in the future, we're not going to try this with anyone else, that's not going to be very much solace. It's all voluntary on the part of the government. That doesn't give you any guarantee. The whole point about a police state isn't that it always acts to silence people or to imprison them or to torture them. It's that the sword of Damocles hangs over all of us all the time. That has an enormous chilling effect. We've seen it with law firms. We've seen it with respect to universities. And sure, it would be good if Mr. Garcia were released. But until the government begins to recognize and act in accord with the recognition that it is bound by the law and not just by its own preferences, we will all be in great danger.
That is Harvard Law Professor Emeritus Lawrence Tribe. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Scott.
These days, bringing a dead musician, quote, back to life, or at least attempting to, can be as straightforward as typing prompts into an AI system. With that in mind, a group of Australian artists and scientists have extended the artistic output of one deceased American composer in a different way by rebuilding some of his brain. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports.
The composer Alvin Lucier was known for experimental works that explored the physical properties of sound. He strapped sensors to his forehead to transform his own brainwaves into a piece for percussion instruments and mined the resonance of everyday objects like pencils. Lucia died in 2021 at the age of 90, but the composer, or rather a surrogate created out of biological matter taken from his body with his permission before he died, is now putting out new music. Lucia's posthumous composition comes from a new installation at the Art Gallery of Western Australia in Perth called Revivification. Artist Nathan Thompson is one of its creators.
We have developed a brain on a dish, more or less, that has the ability to take action in the real world.
This brain on a dish takes the form of two small white blobs on a pedestal at the gallery. The blobs are a cluster of neurons that mimic in a very basic way the structure and development of a human brain. Thompson says it was grown out of stem cells created from blood samples the composer agreed to donate to the project the year before he died.
He was aware of possibilities that the work would perform for him even after his death.
A video about the Revivification installation describes how the blobs, aka Alvin Lucia's surrogate self, make new music.
Surrounding this are 20 handcrafted brass plates.
These plates are attached to the walls like paintings. Also connected to the brain matter, they respond to its neural signals in real time with sound.
Revivification proposes a provocative vision of artistic immortality and speculates that Lucia's creative essence persists beyond death.
Creativity has two components.
Indre Viscontis is a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of San Francisco who studies creativity.
One is the originality or the novelty or the uniqueness of the piece, and here, of course, that's in spades.
But Viscontis says the blobs lack the other component that would make them capable of the creativity needed to truly make new art, intention.
Creativity really has to have a conscious element to it, and I don't think this particular piece of art is conscious. Those cells have no intention.
Yet, she says, even though this block of cells doesn't capture Lucia's creative essence, it's powerful because the composer was a partner in the creation of the piece. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Police in Pennsylvania have a 38-year-old man in custody in connection with an alleged arson attack at the governor's mansion last night while Governor Josh Shapiro and his family were asleep. Police say the suspect faces charges of attempted murder, terrorism, and arson. No one was hurt, but there is damage to the house. There's no word on a motive. In Ukraine, at least 34 people were killed this morning in a Russian missile attack in the northeastern city of Sumy. More than 100 were wounded. Two ballistic missiles hit the center of the city as residents gathered to celebrate Palm Sunday. And the oldest living gorilla in captivity turns 68 today. Fatu lives in her own enclosure at the Berlin Zoo. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at WallaceFoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. We know that Earth's biodiversity is in crisis, but it's hard to monitor lots of different species at once to know exactly how they are changing. Well, NPR's reporter Ari Daniel met a team of researchers who say they have a technique to do just that across an entire country.
We'll start at the base of a colossal Guanacaste tree erupting out of the ground in northern Belize. At the base of the trunk is a hole I can just peek inside.
Now you can hear them chittering.
I follow Nina Garrett's gaze into that hole. Oh yeah, little guy.
Yeah.
He's on the back wall of the trunk.
Yeah.
It's a common vampire bat. Now, Garrett, who's a biology grad student at York University in Canada, knows that a whole group of these bats reside in this tree. But she's curious if there might also be white-winged vampire bats inside, a different species.
It's always sort of been suspected to be in the area just based on habitat type and range maps.
But bats are elusive and skittish. Most techniques would likely spook any animals roosting here. So how can Garrett tell what's inside this tree? Well, the bats can't hide completely. All creatures, big and small, are forever losing pieces of themselves, little fragments of DNA cast into the environment.
They are shedding hair, could be little skin cells, it could be saliva, even when they, breathe out.
Garrett wants to collect this environmental DNA from inside the tree to deduce who's here. She lays a piece of filter paper atop a small fan, places the apparatus inside the tree, and flips the switch. The fan draws the internal air across the filter, trapping free-floating DNA, which Garrett can analyze later for the presence of not just bats, but any mammal, and, if she wanted, plants and fungi, too. That's the power of this technique. It can catalog the array of living things in and around this trunk. Problem is, a single tree hollow doesn't tell you how species are doing on a grander scale. And Elizabeth Clare, a biodiversity scientist at York University, wanted to think bigger.
We wanted to see whether we could measure biodiversity on the scale of an entire country.
But she didn't know how to even attempt such a thing. Then, a few years ago, a team of British chemists and physicists reached out with an idea. This group monitors pollution levels across the UK using a network of stations that continuously draw air from the environment across little discs of filter paper, a lot like the setup in that Guanacaste tree.
Those same systems, it turns out, have been accidentally capturing this airborne DNA that we want at the same time.
Claire and her colleagues took about a year's worth of these filters and analyzed them for DNA. They were astonished by what they found. Hundreds of different kinds of insects and spiders, a heap of plants and fungi, and more than 100 species of birds and mammals. Each filter disc on its own stored just a morsel of information.
But when you have hundreds of them being collected all the time at spatially distributed scales, and you step back, all of those dots coalesce into a picture.
A picture of the biodiversity of a nation and how that picture is changing. The results appear in a preprint article that hasn't yet been peer-reviewed. Ryan Kelly studies environmental DNA at the University of Washington and wasn't involved in the research. He says that unlike a traditional census, DNA is a fuzzier representation of how various organisms are living at a specific place and time. But he finds the approach compelling, given the possibilities it might open up.
If we have biodiversity management questions, all sorts of environmental impact questions, things that we've never really known how to do at scale before, I think this paper points the way to doing that.
And this may be the beginning of bigger things to come, given that these kinds of stations that monitor pollution are distributed in many places around the world, says Elizabeth Clare.
If we can do it at a level of a country, we can do it at a level of a continent. This is something that truly could scale to huge, almost planetary measurements.
Imagine that, an ongoing census of global biodiversity pulled right out of thin air. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
Religion has been a source material for art as long as there has been art and been religion. And that has certainly been the case with movies. From the silent film era's exploration of faith in films like The Passion of Joan of Arc to the recent Best Picture nominee Conclave.
If there was only certainty and no doubt, there would be no mystery, and therefore no need for faith.
And even for those of us who live more secular lives, movies continue to offer a bit of a cinematic catechism with stories from the Bible and other religious traditions. And with Passover and Holy Week underway, we figured it would be a good time to talk about faith and film. I'm joined by NPR's religion correspondent, Jason DeRose. Hey, Jason.
Hello.
And we are joined by Michelle Martin, who hosts Morning Edition, but much more importantly for us, is the longtime host of All Things Considered on the Weekends. Welcome back, Michelle.
It's absolutely much more important. Thank you so much for having me back.
We are thrilled to have you here. Let's start with this. Jason, I guess there's a lot of movies where spirituality or religious themes permeate them, but there is also a big genre of explicitly religious movies. What is your general view of that genre? Does it work for you? Do you have some problems with it?
Yeah, they just don't really work for me. I respond badly to them. For instance, biblical epics, I find them incredibly hokey. This is where I will admit that I have never seen the film The Ten Commandments.
Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, let my people go.
Slaves are mine. Their lives are mine. All that they own is mine.
But the ones that I have seen, such as, you know, The Greatest Story Ever Told, I'm kind of confused by who really watches them and who really loves them and finds them, like, religiously meaningful to them. Mm-hmm. Because I just, you know, I focus on, like, they wouldn't have been doing that, or, you know, Jesus didn't have blue eyes.
Can I throw shade right now? Because we watch the Ten Commandments every year.
Okay.
And it's just because it's like going to grandma's house and getting those butterscotch candies, right? Mm-hmm. It's just something you do. Yeah. To me, that's not a religious film. That's like a family film that you see with your grandma.
Do either of you have, and I can go first, but whether it's the kind of movies that religious themes are infused or whether it's overtly religious movies, is there one that comes to mind, an entry point? Like, I'll say for me, I went to Catholic school, I went to a Jesuit school, and we had to watch, like, every year, I feel like we had to watch that mid-80s movie, The Mission, about South American Jesuit missionaries.
They say it was the will of God that they came out of the jungle and built the mission. They don't understand why God has changed his mind.
I think it has a great soundtrack that holds up. I have not revisited it in a long time as an adult with a more nuanced view of the world, but I feel like that is a front and center movie from this genre for me. I'm curious about the two of you.
Well, I have a very specific group of religion movies that I actually like quite a lot, and they are comedies. They're the Monty Python films, The Life of Brian, The Holy Grail, The Meaning of Life. The Meaning of Life has one of the funniest songs I have ever heard in my life, Every Sperm is Sacred.
Every sperm is sacred, every sperm is great. If a sperm is wasted, God gets quite irate.
This probably says a lot about me and my sense of humor and my approach to religion.
It totally does.
Which is,
just
you
saying.
Know, you know, approach it with a real sense of humor.
One of my favorite films, if you want to call it a religious film, is The Apostle with Robert Duvall.
Now tell me,
Should I lay hands on myself? What should I do? I know I'm a sinner and a once in a while womanizer, but I'm your servant.
To me, it really shows like the adult version of the Bible, which is that in this film, he's actually a terrible person, but he is a great spiritual leader. And you just have to sit with that. I mean, he does all the things. He's drinking, he's cheating. But then when he goes to plant a church, he is truly gifted in this area. And I just think that you have to sit with that. I think a lot of people, particularly who, as you put it earlier, Scott, live more secular lives, struggle with like, how can that be that you could follow this person religiously or spiritually while knowing or suspecting that that person doesn't have this pristine kind of personal life or their personal behavior is somehow lacking. I just look at that. And to me, I know it's a fictional film, but it's kind of like a documentary for me because I think it explains a lot.
There are days that define your story beyond your life. Like the day they arrived.
The other film that is like Arrival, for example, which
yes.
is again, like science, it's supposedly science fiction, right? But like, I think a lot of films in sci-fi also, or that are technically sci-fi, actually live in a spiritual space because they ask hard questions. What is the meaning of existence and how do we know?
And how do we deal with fate?
Despite knowing the journey and where it leads, I embrace it.
Religious themes are obviously big overarching things that people have been trying to figure out for thousands and thousands of years with mixed success. And it's almost like sometimes if a movie tries to bite off too much of that big idea, it's going to falter because it's so weighty and it's hard to tell a good story. And maybe humor is the better way through it. But like, do you think that there are examples of a movie trying to be a big, sweepy religious movie and just biting off more than it can chew?
I just don't think every movie is for everyone. Like, just like Jason was throwing shade at the Ten Commandments. Well, the Ten Commandments is a good movie for kids. You know, there's bad guy, there's good guy, and there's the guy who thinks that he's supposed to be the man and then he's not, and jealousy and miracles.
He opens the waters before them, and he bars our way with fire. Let us go from this place. Men cannot fight against a god.
A friend of mine, who's a rabbi, called it pediatric Judaism.
that's a great turn of phrase.
So okay, what's so terrible?
What is a film that you would maybe recommend to particularly someone who's agnostic or a non-believer to as an endpoint for how faith can move people so deeply and also make a good movie?
Well, one of my favorite religion movies is one from the 1980s called Babette's Feast. And it's the story of this sect of pietist Lutherans in 19th century Denmark who, through some strange circumstances, get a French cook to live in their house. And she prepares this incredibly lavish meal for these very stern pietist Lutherans. And she just melts their heart with delicious things, with wine and food. And there's this beautiful little section where one of the guests, whose heart has melted because of this amazing food that he was given, he says, "The moment comes when we realize grace is infinite. We need only wait for it with confidence and acknowledge it with gratitude. Grace makes no condition." It is such a beautiful, beautiful movie.
He stole my recommendation. I was totally going to
say
Babette's Feast.
Oh, really?
Beyond that, I would say Conclave.
Father Bellini.
Aldo.
Am I the last?
Not quite. How are you?
Oh, well, you know, fairly dreadful.
It's beautifully photographed. You don't have to be Catholic. I think if you're a person who's anti-religion or feels like, oh my gosh, it's just so much politics, you're going to be fine. But, you know, you'll enjoy that part. But if you think, you know, there might be more to it despite that, the politics and so forth, then it also, I think, shares an important word about the enduring power of faith, whether it is your faith or not, or whether you have a faith or not.
Plus, I think we can all agree that it's nice to look at the Sistine Chapel.
I'm sorry, I'm going for the costumes. I mean, the outfits are fabulous.
Isabella Rossellini is worth the price of admission.
That is NPR's religion correspondent, Jason DeRose. Jason, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Michelle Martin, always great to have you back on the weekends with us. Really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Meta is headed to court tomorrow in a major legal challenge to its social networking dominance. In 2012, the social media giant bought Instagram. A few years later, it bought WhatsApp. The Federal Trade Commission is arguing these two purchases stifled competition and created a monopoly. In 2020, the FTC in nearly every state brought charges against the company. Tomorrow on All Things Considered, NPR tech correspondent Bobby Allen on the biggest case in Meta's history and how it may change the company as we know it. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Well, this is awkward. And you know what? Many things are. It is a painful part of life, especially when our most mortifying moments can come back to haunt us. But LifeKit reporter Andy Tagle says there's a lot of power to be found in embracing your awkwardness.
If you're often visited by the ghosts of humiliations past, maybe when you're just trying to sleep or when a familiar song comes on, it might help to know that there's an actual term people use for these mental intruders, cringe attacks. These flashbacks might feel random, but
a time that you were really, really afraid or really angry, anything that's like emotionally heightened is going to stick in our brains.
Melissa Dahl is a writer and the author of Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. The thing about embarrassment, she says, it's not universal. It's relative, uniquely formed by our culture, our social context, and our sense of self to help guide us back to the safety of our clans. So you might look at these memories as alarm bells. Remember, stick with the group. Don't stray too far from the cave.
And if you were cast out, you would be like, you know, eaten by a saber-toothed tiger or something like that. And it's always treated as if that doesn't apply to today.
But we all know there can still be real consequences when we don't follow social norms.
Isolation and loneliness is incredibly damaging. We still depend on social connection for our health and well-being and just general happiness.
So embarrassment is a pro-social tendency that can be positive in a lot of ways. For example, one study out of UC Berkeley from 2011 suggested that people who were more easily embarrassed were seen as more trustworthy and more generous than their less easily embarrassed counterparts. But of course, that doesn't help how much embarrassment can sting in the moment. So what can you do about it? One thing to remember is that your self-conscious feelings aren't always accurate. Take this famous study out of Cornell that Dahl told me about on something called the spotlight effect.
And it's basically like we assume more people are paying attention to our faults and our embarrassing missteps than they are.
So in this study, researchers put a bunch of participants in a room and then had one person show up 5 minutes later.
And they made them wear a really silly t-shirt.
Really silly. It featured a large picture of Barry Manilow.
Afterwards, they asked them, okay, how many people do you think will remember that you're wearing this ridiculous t-shirt?
T-shirt wearing participants guessed that number would be about half. In reality, less than a quarter remembered who was on the shirt.
Which kind of cracks me up because the advice typically goes like, oh, like no one's paying attention to you anyway. And like, that's not actually what the study found. Like some people are, just not as many people as we think.
So relax. Even if you showed up to that meeting with a rip in your pants, chances are most of the people in the room didn't notice or didn't mind. If you're frequented by the same intense, embarrassing memories, there are some other things you can try to soften the edges a bit. One study showed that if you can shift your focus to other details surrounding a cringe attack, like what furniture was in the room at the time, you might be able to lessen the strength of the emotion tied to that memory. But you could also just, you know, try giving yourself a break or maybe even a pat on the back.
Thank God I'm cringing over my past self because that suggests some personal growth, hopefully.
Dahl says the more you can lighten up and laugh it off, the better. Because embarrassment can be isolating, but it doesn't have to be.
These feelings are just so wrapped up in empathy and connectedness. Even if it's horrible in the moment, you just have to remember that, like, it's going to make a really good story eventually.
For NPR's Life Kit, I'm Andy Tagle.
For more tips, check out Life Kit at npr.org/lifekit. This is NPR News.
Since President Trump took office, some researchers feel emboldened to talk about the COVID lab leak theory. Others feel discouraged from discussing topics like climate change.
Science is about proposing new ideas and hypotheses. We can't do that if certain areas are deemed off limits.
Science and the State of the First Amendment, Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Trump is scheduled to meet tomorrow at the White House with the Salvadorian president. The Trump administration sent deported migrants to a supermax prison in El Salvador, including at least one man by mistake. A federal judge has ordered that man be returned, but so far that hasn't happened. The White House today released the results of President Trump's physical exam last week. It listed his height as 75 inches and his weight as 224 pounds. And the White House physician concluded Trump exhibits excellent cognitive and physical health. And at the weekend box office, a Minecraft movie took the top spot again with an estimated $80 million in ticket sales. The video game adaptation is already the top-grossing Hollywood release of the year so far. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at CySimsFoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. During President Trump's first term, dozens of Chinese academics were investigated for potential espionage. Thousands more students from China had their visas canceled and revoked. Many of these measures were later scaled back after criticism of their effectiveness and for alleged racial profiling. But now, as NPR's Emily Fang reports, there is a push to bring this approach back.
Kevin Wong left China in 2020 after what he describes as years of intense persecution for critical remarks he made about Chinese politics. And eventually, after he'd applied for asylum in the U.S., he found a job at New College of Florida, a public institution where he teaches Mandarin language classes. That is, until this past March, when he was abruptly summoned by university administrators.
The HR staff and general counsel were already waiting with a notice of contract termination. They asked me to present my immigration documents.
This is not Wong's real voice. NPR had a producer read aloud a statement he'd prepared for this piece. Wong requested NPR not to use his voice nor his Chinese name because he fears for the safety of his family who are still in China. He said he thought he'd be safe in the U.S., but now his employer was citing something called the Florida Board of Governors Regulation 9.012 and firing him. That rule prohibits Florida from using public funds to pay for services from people from what are called countries of concern. Countries like Russia, Iran, and China. Wong said he was shocked.
As a foreign scholar seeking asylum in the U.S., I had obtained the legal permission to work here.
But he lacked permanent residency, and so he was booted in March. New College did not respond to NPR's request for comment. Wong's termination coincides with a bill put forward by House Republicans in Washington last month that seeks to ban all students from China from receiving visas to study or do research in the U.S. The bill was proposed by West Virginia Representative Riley Moore, who said he thinks a big source of espionage is coming from Chinese students.
Since the November election, a lot of the red states are becoming more emboldened and aggressive in terms of implementing so-called anti-China policies and legislations.
This is Clay Ju, a lawyer who has been active litigating many of the cases concerning Chinese academics. In March, he convinced a court to issue a preliminary injunction halting a Florida law that makes it virtually impossible for students from China and other countries of concern from studying here. He's currently trying to overturn another Florida law that prohibits them from working in public university research labs. He thinks the focus on anyone from China...
Anyone from China or anyone with any Chinese connection, that's a wholesale treatment of people from one particular country as a national security threat.
Meanwhile, six major research universities, including Stanford and Carnegie Mellon, have just been tasked by John Molinar, a Republican representative from Michigan who chairs a House committee on China, to disclose which of their labs employ Chinese citizens, the research they do, how these students are paying for their tuition, and whether anyone has ties to Chinese institutions. His fear, Chinese students, quote, transfer knowledge back to China. NPR reached out to all six universities which received the letter. None wanted to comment on the record.
Senate Bill 17 is about ensuring that Texas's land and natural resources do not fall into the hands of an adversarial nation or their agents.
And then in March, Texas's state legislature revived this proposal that had fizzled out 2 years earlier, an alien land law banning any person from China and other countries of concern from buying any kind of land or real estate, matching a law already on the books in Florida. Opponents worry about racial profiling. China is not the biggest foreign owner of American land. European countries are. And they point out Texas already bans foreign companies from buying up critical infrastructure like energy.
They still need to approve where I'm from, where I'm originally from, or which is my status of my citizenship. Those is discrimination for sure.
This is Jarlene Jha, who lives in northern Texas and who protested outside the state legislature against the bill. Another opponent, Texas resident June Hsu, says some Asian Americans are considering moving out of the Republican-dominated state. But she says that's not the solution.
Our ancestors actually fought against these bills 80 years ago, and we fought furiously. We need to bring it back.
Bring back that spirit of resistance, she says, because she and other Asian Americans fear there will be more measures like it coming. Emily Fang, NPR News.
When you stand at a street corner in Lower Manhattan, it can feel like you're in the middle of a kaleidoscope of constant frantic motion. Cars, trucks, and city bikes buzzing past, people brushing by, sounds everywhere. But it wasn't all that long ago, just 400 years or so, when most of Manhattan was a pastoral landscape. Streams and brooks crisscrossed the island. Native Americans were the main inhabitants. And at the southern tip, Dutch settlers began to build a small trading post. Those early days, and the hundreds of years of history that have come since, they're present on the streets today, if you know where to look.
Hey.
Good morning.
Hey, I'm Scott.
Hi, Scott. I'm Keith.
Nice to
very
meet
nice
you.
To meet
How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Writer, urban historian, and tour guide Keith Tallien knows where to look.
This isn't a normal tour. I'm not going to point at the Empire State Building as if you've never seen it before.
His new book, Walking New York City, Manhattan History on Foot, takes a deep dive into how the streetscapes of New York took shape over the centuries.
The population really only had one direction to grow, which was northward, toward where we're now standing and toward Greenwich Village.
Tallien's book is divided into 12 self-guided walking tours that snake through the history of Manhattan's neighborhoods. I met him on a chilly spring day to stroll through Greenwich Village, an area New Yorkers once considered the outer reaches of the city.
They would come up here during the summer, or what old newspapers refer to as the disease season, to hide out in their rented houses or their country manors in Greenwich. There are echoes of that in more recent years with people fleeing to the Hudson Valley and the Berkshires during COVID. They were doing the same thing 200 years ago, coming to Greenwich during waves of typhoid or yellow fever. It's the same thing, different verse.
Disease season.
Disease season, absolutely.
Our tour through time leads us from the neighborhood's beginnings. It's a farming outpost. Through the Gilded Age and Industrial Revolution to the gay liberation movement of the late 20th century.
But from here, we're going to walk from Astor Place west toward Washington Square and eventually crossing 6th Avenue into historic Greenwich Village.
Let's do it.
Cool. Let's go.
Our next stop looks like any other loft building in the current neighborhood, but it has a dark history. It's the site of one of New York City's most gruesome disasters.
So this building, the Ash Building, was built in 1901 by about 1905.
It was the site of the Triangle Waste Company, a garment manufacturing factory that made a popular style of women's shirts.
What makes this building and the Triangle Waste Company so famous is what happened on March 25th, 1911.
When a fire broke out in the factory and spread rapidly through the top three floors of the building.
What the workers of the Triangle Waste Company found almost immediately as the flames washed through their factory were that all the exits were padlocked shut. They were locked inside. On the one hand, most obviously, it was to prevent them from taking illicit breaks, smoke breaks, sneaking out to the fire escape or the hallway to chat. But more importantly, and what's less talked about, is the locked doors were likely a way to keep these employees from agitating for union organization by cutting them off from each other between the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors. But what this did was prevent them from being able to escape the fire when it broke out.
The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire claimed 146 lives, many of them young women from immigrant families.
There was a massive outpouring of rage and grief in the immediate aftermath, huge protest marches through the city.
It led to a swell of support for unionization and for workplace safety laws. But it took more than a century for a proper memorial to be built. A gleaming black marble belt surrounds the outside of the building. Looking down on it, you can see the names of the victims reflected in its surface. We visit the site just a few days after the anniversary of the fire. Carnations and chalk messages surround the building. Tallien says the fire served as a marker for the end of the Gilded Age, an era remembered for its extreme wealth.
But for the vast majority of New Yorkers, the realities of early 20th century New York was one of destitution, desperation, disease, overcrowding, and in the case of the Triangle Waste Factory, death by fire in their workplace.
Tallien guides us around corners and through crosswalks to Washington Square Park, where we sit on a bench to talk and watch the squirrels.
Tell me about how you decided to first take to social media and start putting these tours on social media.
It started in 2012 with a blog.
What was your platform of choice in 2012? Important question.
Blogspot. That's when I invented the name Keith York City.
.blogspot.com.
KeithYorkCity.blogspot.com, which still exists. Every now and then I get some comments on there from wayward people on the internet, but it was 2012. I'd stumbled into a completely unrelated corporate job that had nothing to do with my academic background or interests, which was fine. It paid the rent, but I still had this need to study and write about history.
He eventually migrated from Blogspot to Instagram, where he began to build a loyal following.
And take me to 2020, because I think, like many people in a lot of things, this really changes for you, takes on a new dimension for you in 2020 when, to go back to what we were talking about before, disease season arrives again, and New York City is a very frightening place to be.
Yeah. So in 2020, when the pandemic began, I had been at my corporate job for about a decade, and almost immediately got furloughed and eventually laid off. But with no job for the first time in my adult life, and this deep sense of foreboding that was pervasive in the city in 2020, I decided to fill my now empty days by walking every street in Manhattan.
Tallien walked nearly 1,000 miles of those empty streets from the Battery in Lower Manhattan to its northern outpost of Marble Hill. As he narrated it all post by post, his online audience grew.
Congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Yeah.
So much so that he gets recognized on our walk. During the pandemic, people started asking if he would lead walking tours.
So now we're walking through Washington Square toward the arch on the north side of the park. The arch is the most notable landmark in the park.
We continue our tour, and as we walk, Tallien points out that most beloved brownstones aren't actually made from brownstone.
This is actually a repair job, where the original brownstone had to be shaved down to its core, covered in cement.
He explains why the Erie Canal was crucial to making New York City the place it is today.
Specifically meant to help funnel the nation's economy down through New York.
And he shows us where the Weather Underground accidentally blew up their secret bomb-making lab in 1970.
And they were assembling bombs in the basement of the house. One of the bombs went off prematurely.
All as we wind our way to another well-known site in Greenwich Village.
So now we're at a pretty famous historical landmark in Greenwich Village that I think a lot of people are familiar with the name, if not the specific history, and that is the Stonewall Inn.
Yeah, the Stonewall here across the street started out as two buildings.
The Stonewall Inn, like other gay bars in the 1960s, was owned by the mob. The Genovese crime family paid off local cops to allow them to operate a gay bar at a time when many aspects of queer life were still illegal.
Cops in exchange would raid the bars once a month or so in exchange for allowing the bar to continue operating. So the mob family would make a massive profit off of this captive audience that they knew they'd have because they weren't welcome anywhere else.
During one of those routine raids in June 1969, something surprising happened. The patrons fought back against the police. They threw rocks and bottles. And eventually, the police had to barricade themselves inside the Stonewall Inn.
It was, for all intents and purposes, the first time that the queer community of Greenwich Village pushed back in a physical, real way against the authorities.
The Stonewall Riots, as they're known now, marked a major shift in the queer liberation movement. We are standing next to the tiny sliver of a national monument in a brick plaza across the street from the Stonewall Inn. The park is covered in stickers and flags showing solidarity with transgender people.
So this is part of the National Park Service. This is a federal plaque here. It still says LGBTQ, but you've seen on the website, at least initially, the same erasing that's happening elsewhere.
In some places on the website, they've removed the T and the Q. Physically, they have not yet come to remove it from the signage here. I think there would be a lot of pushback against that.
Talian says it is not the first time trans people have been erased from Stonewall's history. He points out that trans activists Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera were a key part of the queer liberation movement following Stonewall, but that their contributions and involvement were swept under the rug for many years.
Their story, the arc of their involvement in the story, is proof positive that you can only keep those things suppressed for so long.
As our tour comes to a close, we make our way back to Washington Square Park.
And we're standing in the shadow of what is thought to be the oldest tree still standing in Manhattan, estimated to be at least 300 years old, likely older.
It is a towering English elm stretching 7 or 8 stories into the sky with a huge, craggy trunk. We asked Talian to read the passage about the tree, nicknamed Elma, from his book.
It may have been a sapling when the British took New Amsterdam from the Dutch. It would have been a century old when George Washington was inaugurated as the nation's first president on Wall Street. It turned 200 just after the Civil War and 300 sometime in our or our parents' lifetimes. It is undoubtedly one of the oldest trees in the city, as most of its contemporaries fell long ago.
Just the idea that this tree behind us, that we're looking at right now, that's still living, would have been a century old at the beginning of the founding of this country.
Right. And it's a living thing that has overseen the entire growth and evolution of not just Greenwich Village, but of the entire city and the evolution of the United States as a nation. When this was planted, most of what we see around us would have still been open farmland. And so it's just amazing that in its own way, this tree has borne witness to quite literally everything we've talked about, everything that is to be talked about in New York City's history. This tree has been here through all that every year, hopefully in perpetuity, continuing to leaf out.
Keith Talian is the author of Walking New York City. His book is out on April 15th. That is All Things Considered for this Sunday. I'm Scott Detrow. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you again soon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From the University at Buffalo, the University at Buffalo is developing new AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.